which is Park versus Astru. Ms. Goldblum?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Marcy Goldblum on behalf of the claimant in this case, Ronald Park. Your Honors, this is also a case having to do with the Equal Access to Justice Act. In this case, the district court remanded the case, ruling in Mr. Park's favor, and then on the EJIA, ruled against Mr. Park. In this case, the district court abused its discretion in denying the EJIA application. When Judge Baker adopted the approved the magistrate judge's recommendation to deny the EJIA, he says, Judge Bernthal opined that the position of the commissioner was, throughout the civil litigation, substantially justified. Now, that's very important because it's our contention that the district court applied an erroneous standard evaluating the EJIA in this case. In his approximately two paragraphs where he discusses the EJIA in this case, the magistrate judge cites to a case from the Northern District of Indiana, Harris versus Astru, and says, in making the determination regarding the issue of substantial justification, the court must look at the, quote, conduct of the commissioner throughout the civil litigation, period. Well, the problem with that is that the magistrate judge leaves out a portion of what the Harris case says, and that's, considering whether the commissioner was substantially justified, the court is to analyze the position of the commissioner, which refers to the conduct of the commissioner throughout the civil litigation, including pre-litigation conduct. That's what the magistrate judge left out, the pre-litigation conduct. And when you look at page 2 of the magistrate judge's assessment of whether there's substantial justification, you look, what you see is that he's just looking at the litigation position. He says, after stating that the standard of review is the commissioner's conduct throughout the civil action, he says, the undersigned has concluded that the position of the commissioner was substantially justified. First, the court agreed with the commissioner about evidence that had been submitted to the appeals council. Furthermore, the commissioner was correct in arguing. Accordingly, the commissioner's arguments that flow from the ALJ's credibility determination, and it's all in that paragraph, all that's talked about is the commissioner's litigation position. Well, that not only is an abuse of discretion in this case, but it really misses what I think is one of the crucial aspects here, is that not once in talking about whether EJIA fees should be awarded, whether the commissioner's position was substantially justified, does the magistrate judge or the district court judge refer to the fact that the ALJ's conduct in this case was so egregious that...
Has your client actually received benefits?
Yes, actually he has. What happened, interestingly, he filed a second application while the case was still at the appeals council. It was an SSI case, so he was awarded benefits as of the date of the SSI application based on the fact that he met the preliminary listings. Right now what we're talking about...
But was there an actual remand to the Social Security Administration?
Yes, there was a remand.
But you're suggesting he got his benefits through another application?
No, partially. But the issue that was before this district court, that was before the administrative law judge, the appeals council remanded that, did affirm the favorable portion from the second application, but sent it back with the order that it go to a different administrative law judge. That hearing was held the middle of November before a different administrative law judge. We don't have the outcome of that yet.
Well, now I'm lost. Has he been awarded benefits? I thought you said he'd been awarded benefits.
He was awarded while the case was pending at the appeals council in 2007. He filed a subsequent SSI application.
Based on his current physical condition?
Well, in an SSI application, Social Security will only award benefits no farther back than the date of the application. So only going from, I believe, October 19th, 2007.
Okay, but his application for benefits in this case is still open, isn't that correct?
Correct, yes.
Yeah. He got benefits for what may have been a deterioration in his condition.
It's possible, certainly.
Right, okay.
There's still an issue of about 3 3/4 years from January of 2004
right.
to October of 2007.
Okay, so that's open, okay.
But at any rate, we have in this case the district court making the extraordinary measure of ordering that the case be heard and decided by a different ALJ. That's not done lightly by the district courts. And the ALJ's conduct leading to the litigation is not discussed at all by the district court.
Now, suppose that on when this proceeding is completed, suppose the commissioner decides that your client is not entitled to benefits, and suppose that's affirmed by the district court and by this court, would you still be entitled to fees?
Yes.
Even if in the end?
Yes.
How does that work? I'm not...
Because... One of the fundamentals of justice.
I'm not quarreling with. I just wanted. But is that settled law that if you get a remand?
No, just getting a remand doesn't.
No, no. What I mean is, suppose that we agreed with you that the remand was based on the district judge's view that the commission's position wasn't substantially justified, and. But I guess what is puzzling about that is that. Is that how? I mean, suppose we agreed with you that the ALJ's decision had not been substantially justified, but then in the end, Park doesn't get benefits. Wouldn't there be an inconsistency there?
I don't believe so. And here's where that whole. Interesting part of the law developed. Before the cases of Melkonian from the Supreme Court, EJA fees weren't available until the case had been completely settled and won. So that type of a scenario didn't come up. You didn't win, you couldn't come back to court mm-hmm. to get the EJA fees. After the development of Melkonian and how sentence 4 and sentence 6 fit into the big picture, the idea was that in a sentence 4 remand, such as this case, the plaintiff won by virtue of the remand.
Uh-huh.
Then the question became, was the government substantially justified looking at it up to this point? So that if the administrative law judge, and hence the position of the government, was not substantially justified, and I think even more so in a case like this, where we have the possibility of procedural anomaly in the sense that the plaintiff may not have received a full and fair hearing, that we're talking about the very fundamentals of justice and our the system of review not being adhered to.
Is that aspect of your argument entirely based on the exchange with the ALJ over what the witness Nicholson had said about the petitioner moving in with him?
That's not the only reason why we were saying that the commissioner's position is not substantially justified, but I think that it's something that had to be reviewed and was ignored by the district court when they were looking at EJA. I mean,
well, it wasn't ignored. I mean, it did say the commissioner did acknowledge that the ALJ's credibility determinations to Mr. Nicholson was improper.
Well,
so I don't think you can say the district judge ignored the point.
Well, I think it's one thing to note that the commissioner acknowledged that the ALJ's credibility determinations to Mr. Nicholson was improper, but it's another thing to recognize that on the merits, both the magistrate judge indicated that he thought that there was a possibility that there hadn't been a full and fair hearing, and that the district court judge, in fact, ordered the case heard in front of a new administrative law judge because...
What's the authority for that?
Generally, the authority to do that comes with a finding that there may have been bias. I mean, there really is very little...
That is to say there is no authority for that.
Excuse me?
There is no authority for that sort of order.
Isn't it more of a recommendation?
Generally it is, but in this order, the Judge Baker says on remand the hearing shall be held and decision rendered.
He has no authority to do that. That's an extrajudicial act. He has no authority to do it, and you shouldn't hang your hat on that.
Well, we're not hanging our hat on it.
You've argued it twice now, and you briefed it extensively.
Well,
without acknowledging that that was an extrajudicial act that he had no authority to do.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but we did note that the fact that his merits decision, that the conduct may not have been so egregious to... I believe that we had noted that it was extraordinary and that generally that's only ordered in the cases where they do find bias. And again, it wasn't our point to hang our hat totally on that finding, although I do find it strong language, which is certainly one thing that is looked at in terms of whether the commissioner's position was substantially justified. But that's also in
the whole issue of whether the ALJ exhibited bias, as I understand this record, is based on this disagreement over what Nicholson had testified to, correct? And as I read that aspect of the transcript, my judgment on it is that both the magistrate judge and the district court were substantially overreaching in labeling that as egregious conduct. It clearly wasn't. It was just a disagreement and a tug of war between the ALJ and counsel over what the witness had said. It was not evincing any bias. There was just a disagreement.
The district court did find that the ALJ did mischaracterize in his decision the testimony of Mr. Nicholson and relied on that to find that he was not a credible witness.
That's a mistake. That's not bias. There really isn't any evidence here to support any conclusion that the ALJ was biased. He made a mistake on that testimony, number one, and he overlooked the COPD. Those are the two things that the reversal was based on and the remand was based on.
The overlooking of the COPD, again, was a significant factor. It's an entire line of evidence.
I understand that.
It was an entire line of evidence. We have numerous cases...
What is COPD?
Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
Obstructive pulmonary. So, but the breathing.
The breathing, which is.
The administrator did acknowledge the breathing difficulties, didn't he? And all these drugs that was taking. Does calling it chronic obstructive pulmonary disease add anything to?
It does, actually. And in fact, the breathing
problem. It's emphysema, isn't it?
That's one part of emphysema is considered a COPD illness. But the breathing disorders, such as COPD, they affect someone's stamina, someone's ability to.
Well, that's true of emphysema, yeah.
It affects the individual's ability to sustain an 8-hour workday. The ALJ never discusses how he input the addition of the COPD on this gentleman's ability to function, and that is legal error. Under the Equal Access to Justice Act, his failure to consider an entire line of evidence is on its own enough to find that the commissioner's position wasn't substantially justified and that an award of EJA fees was appropriate.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Goldblum. Ms. Siegel?
morning, Your Honors. My name is Catherine Siegel. I represent the Commissioner of Social Security in this case. The critical issue here is whether the district court abused its discretion in finding that the government's position was substantially justified. That is a very deferential standard of review, and as a result, the court has a rather limited role in reviewing the district court's decision. The court should not disturb the district court's ruling unless the record commands the conclusion that the district court was wrong. Mr. Park carries the burden of showing an abuse of discretion by the district court, and that's a very heavy burden for him to carry, and he has failed to carry it. The district court has acted well within its discretion in finding that the government was substantially justified here and followed the correct standard that this court has set forth, that you consider both the aspects that the government prevailed upon as well as those in which the government erred. Here we have the district court agreeing with the vast majority of positions that were presented by the government. The government's positions with regard to both its with regard to the administrative law judge's decision, which was the subject of the civil action and is part and parcel of the government's position. I think that there's been an attempt by counsel for the appellant to separate out the ALJ's decision from the civil action. And in fact, I think there's a bit of a misrepresentation with regard to the EJA report and recommendation. The magistrate judge absolutely did talk specifically about findings that he found were supported, that the ALJ made. The credibility findings are he makes several specific points about how the reasons were just and sound, and he also talks specifically about the grip and mental impairments and how the ALJ didn't find that those were well supported, and that he specifically referenced the ALJ's decision. So the government's position encompassed the ALJ's decision and the litigation position. It's part and parcel of the same government's position. So we look at that as a whole. Here we have references to appeals counsel evidence of that the district court made with regard to the government's position. They found that the appeals counsel denial of review was not subject to judicial review. That was one of the issues that the claimant raised at the district court level, and the government's position was found to have merit in that, and the district court pointed that out. With regard to the appeals counsel evidence, the government's position also was found to have merit. There was no basis for a remand on the basis of the appeals counsel evidence because it wasn't material. So the district court agreed with our position on that as well. With regard to credibility, there were seven different reasons that the ALJ gave to support his credibility finding. And of those seven, the district court found that six of them were sound and had merit. So on the merits of the case, the district court found that overall the credibility finding of the ALJ had merit. And he pointed out to only one reason, which was the Nicholson's testimony, that was inaccurate and did not provide a good reason for the ALJ's credibility finding. And so when taken in that context, Nicholson's testimony is actually a very small part of the ALJ's decision and in and of itself would not provide a basis for finding that there was no substantial justification for the government's position. In fact, the magistrate judge stated specifically that the ALJ's conduct at the hearing was not so egregious as to warrant reversal solely on that basis. And although it contributed to the remand, it was not, he specifically said it was not so egregious. So the characterization that this was egregious behavior actually doesn't even comport with the magistrate judge's own recollection of that or his own characterization of the ALJ's conduct. With regard to the claimant's impairments, the district court also agreed with many of the positions that were addressed by the claimant or by the government in response to the claimant's criticism of the ALJ decision. The ALJ discussed the claimant's manual grip strength And the district court found that the government's position in that respect was well supported. The ALJ specifically is cited to a Dr. Chapa who had talked about, you know, good grip strength bilaterally. So there's clearly support in the record showing that the ALJ had a valid basis for not limiting that. That would also contribute to the finding that the substantial justification of the government's position was here. The mental impairments, we have also specific things that the ALJ talked about in his decision, which also contributed to the government's position being substantially justified. We have Dr. Lee and Dr. Vincent that were cited by the ALJ, and also the fact that the magistrate judge had rejected the later evidence that was submitted to the Appeals Council as not a basis for changing the ALJ's decision. Under Stewart, it's appropriate for the district court to consider all these findings or all these rulings by the district court that were in the government's favor and looking at the overall position of the government. With regard to the pulmonary impairment, that error by the ALJ was really more of a question of a deficient articulation. The ALJ himself did talk about breathing problems, did talk about the lung impairments, talked about the
treatment. Does he have emphysema? Is that what it is?
I think the diagnosis was chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And then.
Well, is that different from emphysema?
I'm not entirely sure, Your Honor, but that was the diagnosis.
Well, it's odd the administrative law judge wouldn't give a name to the person's.
I think he actually does reference COPD in the decision. What the criticism of the court was regarding the ALJ's treatment of the breathing problems was not that he had ignored it completely. I mean, he did acknowledge that he had breathing problems. He acknowledged the medication. He even acknowledged that there were certain medical findings with regard to the lung condition, the chest X-rays, the clear lungs on examination by Dr. Al-Makib. The ALJ does reference those things. What the court's problem with on the merits was that they felt there wasn't enough of a bridge between what the ALJ was saying and why he didn't assess specific limitations. And the only doctor's report in the record that talks about pulmonary limitations that would be something like exposure to wetness and humidity, temperature extremes, gases and fumes, those kind of limitations, that was in the state agency physician's opinion. And the ALJ did specifically address that. They said that the state agency physician opinion was outdated. It was from 2004, and that there was later evidence and there was other evidence that contradicted the state agency physicians.
This extraordinary array of drugs that he's taking, doesn't that suggest serious?
It's not clear that he was taking them all at the same time. I mean, sometimes with pulmonary impairments, you have certain drugs that you take for.
But these are serious drugs, right? This is like aspirin.
Right, and the ALJ just certainly acknowledged.
He must have some serious problem.
Well, and the problem is we really didn't have much of an assessment. Like his own treating doctor, who looked at his lung problems, didn't actually assess any limitations on the lung condition.
Well, are there any medical reports which say that he has emphysema or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease?
Dr. Al-Makib does diagnose chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. But he talks about him having clear lungs also, and chest X-rays not showing, you know, too bad of findings. And
so did the administrative law judge agrees that he has COPD, and it's just not very serious? Is that the problem?
No, he found it. COPD was a severe impairment. My recollection is he did find a severe pulmonary impairment, but he did not specifically limit the exposure to dust and fumes and things like that. But he did explain that he had rejected the one that the state agency physicians, who were the only ones that would assess those limits. But like I said, that was on the merits. The the court had said that that wasn't enough of a bridge. But what we're looking here with substantial justification is that whether the ALJ had a reasonable belief that he had addressed the pulmonary impairment satisfactorily, and also the commissioner had a reasonable basis for defending those that decision for that finding. And here we do have references that he did consider the pulmonary impairment. He did consider the medications. He did consider specific medical findings. He did provide a basis for rejecting the state agency's physician opinion, although he doesn't specifically talk about the pulmonary aspects of that decision, of that opinion. He does talk about why he rejected the state agency physician opinion. So all those things show reasonableness on the part of the government for defending the position, also reasonableness on the part of the ALJ for thinking that he had adequately covered that impairment.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Your time is expired. So, Ms. Goldblum, how much time does she have? Do you have any time? Do you have, you can have another minute if you have anything further you'd like to say.
Very briefly, plaintiff did not misstate in terms of whether the district court only looked at the litigation stage of in terms of substantial justification. And I think that second paragraph is very clear about that. Finally, the COPD and the medication that this gentleman was taking were very significant. They affect stamina. They affect his ability to function throughout the workday. And in failing to explain the basis for an entire line of evidence and how that affected this individual, the administrative law judge committed legal error. And on the basis of that, the position of the commissioner cannot be found substantially justified, particularly when the ALJ did engage in some, even if it weren't considered egregious, some conduct at the hearing that made the both the magistrate judge and the district court judge question that conduct. We ask that you reverse, find that there's not substantial justification to remand the case. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Goldblum and Ms. Siegel, and court will stand in recess.